The Man in the Brown Suit, Agatha Christie. Chapter 18. Anne's narrative resumed. I don't suppose that as long as I live I shall forget my first sight of Table Mountain. I got up frightfully early and went out on deck. I went right up to the boat deck, which I believe is a heinous offense, but I decided to dare something in the cause of solitude. We were just steaming into Table Bay. There were fleecy white clouds hovering above Table Mountain, and nestling on the slopes below, right down to the sea, was the sleeping town, gilded and bewitched by the morning sunlight. It made me catch my breath and have that curious, hungry pain inside that seizes one sometimes when one comes across something that's extra beautiful. I'm not very good at expressing these things, but I knew well enough that I had found, if only for a fleeting moment, the thing that I had been looking for ever since I left Little Hampsley. Something new, something hitherto undreamed of, something that satisfied my aching hunger for romance. Perfectly silently, or so it seemed to me, the Kilmorden glided nearer and nearer. It was still very like a dream. Like all dreamers, however, I could not let my dream alone. We poor humans are so anxious not to miss anything. This is South Africa, I kept saying to myself industriously. South Africa! South Africa! You are seeing the world. This is the world. You are seeing it. Think of it, Anne Bedingfeld, you pudding head. You're seeing the world. I had thought that I had the boat deck to myself, but now I observed another figure leaning over the rail, absorbed as I had been in the rapidly approaching city. Even before he turned his head, I knew who it was. The scene of last night seemed unreal and melodramatic in the peaceful morning sunlight. What must he have thought of me? It made me hot to realize the things that I'd said, and I hadn't meant them, or had I? I turned my head resolutely away and stared hard at Table Mountain. If Rayburn had come up here to be alone, I, at least, need not disturb him by advertising my presence. But to my intense surprise, I heard a light footfall on the deck behind me, then his voice, pleasant and normal. "Miss Bedingfeld." "Yes." I turned. "I want to apologize to you. I behaved like a perfect bore last night." It was a peculiar night," I said hastily. It was not a very lucid remark, but it was absolutely the only thing I could think of. "Will you forgive me?" I held out my hand without a word. He took it. "There's something else I want to say." His gravity deepened. "Miss Bedingfeld, you may not know it, but you're mixed up in a rather dangerous business." "I gathered as much," I said. "No, you don't. You can't possibly know. I want to warn you. Leave the whole thing alone. It can't concern you, really. Don't let your curiosity lead you to tamper with other people's business. No, please, don't get angry again. I'm not speaking of myself. You've no idea what you might come up against. These men will stop at nothing. They are absolutely ruthless. Already you're in danger. Look at last night. They fancy you know something. Your only chance is to persuade them that they're mistaken. But be careful. Always be on the lookout for danger. And look here. If at any time you should fall into their hands, don't try and be clever. Tell the whole truth. It will be your only chance." "You make my flesh creep, Mr. Rayburn," I said, with some truth. "Why do you take the trouble to warn me?" He didn't answer for some minutes. Then he said in a low voice, "It may be the last thing I can do for you. Once on shore, I shall be all right, but I may not get on shore." "What?" I cried. "You see, I'm afraid you're not the only person on board who knows that I'm the man in the brown suit." "If you think that I told," I said hotly. He reassured me with a smile. I don't doubt you, Miss Bedingfield. If I ever said I did, I lied. No, but there's one person on board who's known all along. He's only got to speak, and my number's up. All the same, I'm taking a sporting chance that he won't speak. Why? Because he's a man who likes playing a lone hand. And when the police have got me, I should be of no further use to him. Free, I might be. Well, an hour will show. He laughed rather mockingly, but I saw his face harden. If he had gambled with fate, he was a good gambler. He could lose and smile. In any case, he said lightly, I don't suppose we shall meet again. No, I said slowly. I suppose not. So, goodbye. Goodbye. He gripped my hand hard. Just for a minute, his curious light eyes seemed to burn into mine. Then he turned abruptly and left me. I heard his footsteps ringing along the deck. They echoed and re-echoed. I felt that I should hear them always. Footsteps going out of my life. I can admit frankly that I did not enjoy the next 2 hours. Not till I stood on the wharf, having finished with most of the ridiculous formalities that bureaucracies require, did I breathe freely once more. No arrest had been made, and I realized that it was a heavenly day, and that I was extremely hungry. I joined Suzanne. In any case, I was staying the night with her at the hotel. The boat didn't go on to Port Elizabeth and Durban until the following morning. We got into a taxi and drove to the Mount Nelson. It was all heavenly. The sun, the air, the flowers. When I thought of little Hampsley in January, the mud knee-deep and the sure-to-be-falling rain, I hugged myself with delight. Suzanne was not nearly so enthusiastic. She has traveled a great deal, of course. Besides, she's not the type that gets excited before breakfast. She snubbed me severely when I let out an enthusiastic yelp at the sight of a giant blue convolvulus. By the way, I should like to make it clear here and now that this story will not be a story of South Africa. I guarantee no genuine local color. You know, that sort of thing. Half a dozen words in italics on every page. I admire it very much, but I can't do it. In South Sea Islands, of course, you make an immediate reference to bêche de mer. I don't know what bêche de mer is. I never have known. I probably never shall know. I've guessed once or twice and guessed wrong. In South Africa, I know you at once begin to talk about a stoep. I do know what a stoep is. It's the thing round a house and you sit on it. In various other parts of the world, you call it a veranda, a piazza, and a ha-ha. Then again, there are pawpaws. I had often read of pawpaws. I discovered at once what they were, because I had one plumped down in front of me for breakfast. I thought at first that it was a melon gone bad. The Dutch waitress enlightened me and persuaded me to use lemon juice and sugar and try again. I was very pleased to meet a pawpaw. I had always vaguely associated it with a hula hula, which I believe, though I may be wrong, is the kind of straw skirt that Hawaiian girls dance in. No, I think I'm wrong. That's a lava lava. At any rate, all these things are very cheering after England. I can't help thinking that it would brighten our cold island life if one could have a breakfast of bacon bacon, and then go out clad in a jumper jumper to pay the books. Suzanne was a little tamer after breakfast. They had given me a room next to hers with a lovely view right out over Table Bay. I looked at the view while Suzanne hunted for some special face cream. When she'd found it and started an immediate application, she became capable of listening to me. "Did you see Sir Eustace?" I asked. "He was marching out of the breakfast room as we went in. He'd had some bad fish or something and was just telling the head waiter what he thought about it. And he bounced a peach on the floor to show how hard it was. Only it wasn't quite as hard as he thought, and it squished." Suzanne smiled. "Sir Eustace doesn't like getting up early any more than I do. But, Anne, did you see Mr. Paget? I ran against him in the passage. He's got a black eye. What can he have been doing?
Only trying to push me overboard, I replied nonchalantly.
It was a distinct score for me. Suzanne left her face half anointed and pressed for details. I gave them to her.
It all gets more and more mysterious, she cried. I thought I was going to have the soft job sticking to Sir Eustace, and that you would have all the fun with the Reverend Edward Chichester, but now I'm not so sure. I hope Paget won't push me off the train some dark night.
I think you're still above suspicion, Suzanne, but if the worst happens, I'll wire to Clarence.
That reminds me. Give me a cable for him. Let me see now. What shall I say?
Implicated in the most thrilling mystery, please send me £1,000 at once. Suzanne.
I took the form from her and pointed out that she could eliminate a the, an and possibly, if she didn't care about being polite, a please. Suzanne, however, appears to be perfectly reckless in money matters. Instead of attending to my economical suggestions, she added three words more. Enjoying myself hugely.
Suzanne was engaged to lunch with friends of hers, who came to the hotel about 11 o'clock to fetch her. I was left to my own devices. I went down through the grounds of the hotel, crossed the tram lines, and followed a cool, shady avenue right down till I came to the main street. I strolled about, seeing the sights, enjoying the sunlight, and the black-faced sellers of flowers and fruits. I also discovered a place where they had the most delicious ice cream sodas. Finally, I bought a 6-penny basket of peaches and retraced my steps to the hotel. To my surprise and pleasure, I found a note awaiting me. It was from the curator of the museum. He had read of my arrival on the Kilmorden, in which I was described as the daughter of the late Professor Bedingfeld. He had known my father slightly, and had had a great admiration for him. He went on to say that his wife would be delighted if I would come out and have tea with them that afternoon at their villa at Mützenberg. He gave me instructions for getting there. It was pleasant to think that poor Papa was still remembered and highly thought of. I foresaw that I would have to be personally escorted round the museum before I left Cape Town, but I risked that. To most people it would have been a treat. But one can have too much of a good thing if one is brought up on it, morning, noon, and night. I put on my best hat, one of Suzanne's cast-offs, and my least crumpled white linen, and started off after lunch. I caught a fast train to Mützenberg, and got there in about half an hour. It was a nice trip. We wound slowly round the base of Table Mountain, and some of the flowers were lovely. My geography being weak, I had never fully realized that Cape Town is on a peninsula. Consequently, I was rather surprised on getting out of the train to find myself facing the sea once more. There was some perfectly entrancing bathing going on. The people had short, curved boards and came floating in on the waves. It was far too early to go to tea. I made for the bathing pavilion, and when they said, "Would I have a surf board?" I said, "Yes, please." "Surfing looks perfectly easy."
"It isn't."
"I say no more." I got very angry and fairly hurled my plank from me. Nevertheless, I determined to return on the first possible opportunity and have another go. I would not be beaten. Quite by mistake, I then got a good run on my board and came out delirious with happiness. Surfing is like that. You are either vigorously cursing, or else you are idiotically pleased with yourself. I found the Villa Medici after some little difficulty. It was right up on the side of the mountain, isolated from the other cottages and villas. I rang the bell, and a smiling Kaffir boy answered it. "Mrs. Raffini?" I inquired. He ushered me in, preceded me down the passage, and flung open a door. Just as I was about to pass in, I hesitated. I felt a sudden misgiving. I stepped over the threshold, and the door swung sharply to behind me. A man rose from his seat behind a table and came forward with outstretched hand.
"So glad we've persuaded you to visit us, Miss Bedingfeld," he said. He was a tall man, obviously a Dutchman, with a flaming orange beard. He didn't look in the least like the curator of a museum. In fact, I realized in a flash that I'd made a fool of myself. I was in the hands of the enemy. Chapter 19. It reminded me forcibly of Episode 3 in The Perils of Pamela. How often had I not sat in the sixpenny seats, eating a twopenny bar of milk chocolate, and yearning for similar things to happen to me? Well, they had happened with a vengeance, and somehow it was not nearly so amusing as I had imagined. It's all very well on the screen. You have the comfortable knowledge that there's bound to be an episode 4. But in real life, there was absolutely no guarantee that Anna the Adventuress might not terminate abruptly at the end of any episode. Yes, I was in a tight place. All the things that Rayburn had said that morning came back to me with unpleasant distinctness. "Tell the truth," he had said. Well, I could always do that, but was it going to help me? To begin with, would my story be believed? Would they consider it likely or possible that I had started off on this mad escapade simply on the strength of a scrap of paper smelling of mothballs? It sounded to me a wildly incredible tale. In that moment of cold sanity, I cursed myself for a melodramatic idiot and yearned for the peaceful boredom of little Hamsley. All this passed through my mind in less time than it takes to tell. My first instinctive movement was to step backwards and feel for the handle of the door. My captor merely grinned. "Here you are, and here you stay," he remarked facetiously. I did my best to put a bold face upon the matter. "I was invited to come here by the curator of the Cape Town Museum. If I've made a mistake..." "A mistake? Oh yes, a big mistake." He laughed coarsely. "What right have you to detain me? I shall inform the police." "Yap, yap, yap, like a little toy dog," he laughed. I sat down on a chair. "I can only conclude that you're a dangerous lunatic," I said coldly. "Indeed." "I should like to point out to you that my friends are perfectly well aware where I have gone, and that if I have not returned by this evening, they will come in search of me. You understand?" "So your friends know where you are, do they? Which of them?" Thus challenged, I did a lightning calculation of chances. Should I mention Sir Eustace? He was a well-known man, and his name might carry weight. But if they were in touch with Paget, they might know I was lying. Better not risk Sir Eustace. "Mrs. Blair, for one," I said lightly, "a friend of mine with whom I'm staying." "I think not," said my captor, slyly shaking his orange head. "You've not seen her since 11 this morning, and you received our note, bidding you come here at lunchtime." His words showed me how closely my movements had been followed, but I was not going to give in without a fight. "You're very clever," I said. "Perhaps you've heard of that useful invention, the telephone. Mrs. Blair called me up on it when I was resting in my room after lunch. I told her then where I was going this afternoon." To my great satisfaction, I saw a shade of uneasiness pass over his face. Clearly, he'd overlooked the possibility that Suzanne might have telephoned to me. I wished she really had done so. "Enough of this," he said harshly, rising. "What are you going to do with me?" I asked, still endeavoring to appear composed. "Put you where you can do no harm in case your friends come after you." For a moment my blood ran cold, but his next words reassured me. "Tomorrow you'll have some questions to answer, and after you've answered them, we shall know what to do with you. And I can tell you, young lady, we've more ways than one of making obstinate little fools talk." It wasn't cheering, but it was at least a respite. I had until tomorrow. This man was clearly an underling obeying the orders of a superior. Could that superior by any chance be Paget? He called, and two Kaffirs appeared. I was taken upstairs. Despite my struggles, I was gagged and then bound hand and foot. The room into which they'd taken me was a kind of attic under the roof. It was dusty and showed little signs of having been occupied. The Dutchman made a mock bow and withdrew, closing the door behind him. I was quite helpless. Turn and twist as I would, I couldn't loosen my hands in the slightest degree, and the gag prevented me from crying out. If, by any possible chance, anyone had come to the house, I could do nothing to attract their attention. Down below I heard the sound of a door shutting. Evidently, the Dutchman was going out. It was maddening not to be able to do anything. I strained again at my bonds, but the knots held. I desisted at last and either fainted or fell asleep. When I awoke, I was in pain all over. It was quite dark now, and I judged that the night must be well advanced, for the moon was high in the heavens and shining down through the dusty skylight. The gag was half choking me, and the stiffness and pain were unendurable. It was then that my eyes fell on a bit of broken glass lying in the corner. A moonbeam slanted right down on it, and its glistening had caught my attention. As I looked at it, an idea came into my head. My arms and legs were helpless, but surely I could still roll. Slowly and awkwardly, I set myself in motion. It wasn't easy. Besides being extremely painful, since I could not guard my face with my arms, it was also exceedingly difficult to keep any particular direction. I tended to roll in every direction except the one I wanted to go. In the end, however, I came right up against my objective. It almost touched my bound hands. Even then, it wasn't easy. It took an infinity of time before I could wriggle the glass into such a position, wedged against the wall, that it would rub up and down on my bonds. It was a long, heart-rending process, and I almost despaired. But in the end, I succeeded in sawing through the cords that bound my wrists. The rest was a matter of time. Once I had restored the circulation to my hands by rubbing the wrists vigorously, I was able to undo the gag. One or two full breaths did a lot for me. Very soon I had undone the last knot, though even then it was some time before I could stand on my feet. But at last I stood erect, swinging my arms to and fro to restore circulation, and wishing above all things that I could get hold of something to eat. I waited about a quarter of an hour to be quite sure of my recovered strength. Then I tiptoed noiselessly to the door. As I had hoped, it was not locked, only latched. I unlatched it and peeped cautiously out. Everything was still. The moonlight came in through a window and showed me the dusty, uncarpeted staircase. Cautiously, I crept down it. Still no sound. But as I stood on the landing below, a faint murmur of voices reached me. I stopped dead and stood there for some time. A clock on the wall registered the fact that it was after midnight. I was fully aware of the risks I might run if I descended lower, but my curiosity was too much for me. With infinite precautions, I prepared to explore. I crept softly down the last flight of stairs and stood in the square hall. I looked round me and then caught my breath with a gasp. A Kaffir boy was sitting by the hall door. He had not seen me. Indeed, I soon realized by his breathing that he was fast asleep. Should I retreat, or should I go on? The voices came from the room I had been shown into on arrival. One of them was that of my Dutch friend. The other I could not for the moment recognize, though it seemed vaguely familiar. In the end, I decided that it was clearly my duty to hear all I could. I must risk the Kaffir boy waking up. I crossed the hall noiselessly and knelt by the study door. For a moment or two, I could hear no better. The voices were louder, but I could not distinguish what they said. I applied my eye to the keyhole instead of my ear. As I had guessed, one of the speakers was the big Dutchman. The other man was sitting outside my circumscribed range of vision. Suddenly he rose to get himself a drink. His back, black clad and decorous, came into view. Even before he turned round, I knew who he was. Mr. Chichester. Now I began to make out the words.
All the same, it is dangerous. Suppose her friends come after her.
It was the big man speaking. Chichester answered him. He had dropped his clerical voice entirely. No wonder I had not recognized it.
All bluff. They haven't an idea where she is.
She spoke very positively. I dare say. I've looked into the matter, and we've nothing to fear. Anyway, it's the colonel's orders. You don't want to go against them, I suppose.
The Dutchman ejaculated something in his own language. I judged it to be a hasty disclaimer.
But why not knock her on the head? He growled. It would be simple. The boat's all ready. She could be taken out to sea.
Yes, said Chichester meditatively. That is what I should do. She knows too much. That is certain. But the colonel is a man who likes to play a lone hand, though no one else must do so. Something in his own words seemed to awaken a memory that annoyed him. He wants information of some kind from this girl. He had paused before the information, and the Dutchman was quick to catch him up.
Information?
Something of the kind.
Diamonds, I said to myself.
And now, continued Chichester, give me the lists. For a long time their conversation was quite incomprehensible to me. It seemed to deal with large quantities of vegetables. Dates were mentioned, prices, and various names of places which I did not know. It was quite half an hour before they had finished their checking and counting.
Good, said Chichester, and there was a sound as though he pushed back his chair. I will take these with me for the colonel to see.
When do you leave?
10 o'clock tomorrow morning will do.
Do you want to see the girl before you go?
No, there are strict orders that no one is to see her until the colonel comes.
Is she all right?
I looked in on her when I came in for dinner. She was asleep, I think.
What about food?
A little starvation will do no harm. The colonel will be here sometime tomorrow. She'll answer questions better if she's hungry. No one had better go near her till then. Is she securely tied up?
The Dutchman laughed.
What do you think?
They both laughed. So did I, under my breath. Then, as the sound seemed to betoken that they were about to come out of the room, I beat a hasty retreat. I was just in time. As I reached the head of the stairs, I heard the door of the room open, and at the same time the Kaffir stirred and moved. My retreat by the way of the hall door was not to be thought of. I retired prudently to the attic, gathered my bonds round me, and lay down again on the floor, in case they should take it into their heads to come and look at me. They didn't do so, however. After about an hour, I crept down the stairs, but the Kaffir by the door was awake and humming softly to himself. I was anxious to get out of the house, but I didn't quite see how to manage it. In the end, I was forced to retreat to the attic again. The Kaffir was clearly on guard for the night. I remained there patiently all through the sounds of early morning preparation. The men breakfasted in the hall. I could hear their voices distinctly floating up the stairs. I was getting thoroughly unnerved. How on earth was I to get out of this house? I counseled myself to be patient. A rash move might spoil everything. After breakfast came the sounds of Chichester departing. To my intense relief, the Dutchman accompanied him. I waited breathlessly. Breakfast was being cleared away. The work of the house was being done. At last, the various activities seemed to die down. I slipped out from my lair once more. Very carefully, I crept down the stairs. The hall was empty. Like a flash, I was across it, had unlatched the door, and was outside in the sunshine. I ran down the drive like one possessed. Once outside, I resumed a normal walk. People stared at me curiously, and I do not wonder. My face and clothes must have been covered in dust from rolling about in the attic. At last, I came to a garage. I went in. "I've met with an accident," I explained. "I want a car to take me to Cape Town at once. I must catch the boat to Durban." I had not long to wait. 10 minutes later, I was speeding along in the direction of Cape Town. I must know if Chichester was on the boat. Whether to sail on her myself or not, I couldn't determine, but in the end, I decided to do so. Chichester would not know that I had seen him in the villa at Mützenberg. He would doubtless lay further traps for me, but I was forewarned. And he was the man I was after, the man who was seeking the diamonds on behalf of the mysterious Colonel. Alas for my plans! As I arrived at the docks, the Kilmorden Castle was steaming out to sea, and I had no means of knowing whether Chichester had sailed on her or not.